I would like to call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, April 26, 2019, and the time is 1:45. My apologies for the late start. We had a few issues come up. Members present today is Representative Knopp, Representative LeBond, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Merrick, Representative Josephson, Representative Sullivan-Leonard, and Representative Ortiz, and I'm Co-Chair Wilson. Today we have HB 20 before us, sexual assault examination kits, and after that will be a presentation by the Criminal Justice Reform. And with that, Representative Tarr, welcome back to the committee. If you would please put yourself on the record and your trustee aide, you may begin your testimony. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Representative Garen Tarr from Anchorage.
And Stephanie Andrew, staff to Representative Tarr.
We're going to go through the PowerPoint to explain the bill and hopefully do it in just not too long. But I did want to ask members if they would also get something out to help with context. It's the STAR, Standing Together Against Rape, 2019 Policy Priorities. And it should be in your packet.
We all have it.
Okay, perfect. Because there's two parts to this bill. One part deals with one of the items that's one of their 2019 priorities, and then the second part of the bill is related to what I call the next phase of the rape kit reform. And so just to talk a little bit about the rape kit portion of it, because for members who have been here, you'll remember some of this work over the last few years. And for new folks, just want to kind of loop you in. We started working on this in the fall of 2014, and at that time we didn't know the number of untested rape kits that we had. So step one was completing an audit, and we were able to get that into another crime bill and get the audit. So that's how we learned we had 3,400 untested rape kits. At the same time, there was also a crime lab audit that went in. We found some problems with the way rape kits were handled through the crime lab. For example, prior to the audit, there was not a chain of custody system. So the rape kits were prepared in Anchorage, and they were sent out to the over 200 law enforcement agencies statewide, but with no tracking information. So there's no way to know once it left Anchorage whether it ever went and was used or misused or lost. So as a result of that crime lab audit, now they have a new system in place. So there's a unique identifier for every kit as it leaves the crime lab in Anchorage, goes out to whatever law enforcement agency uses it, and then comes back. Another piece of that is that they'll all be stored in Anchorage. So that was part of the crime lab audit piece. Some other provisions came into House Bill 31, and we've been working with a national organization called the Joyful Heart Foundation, and they have what they call the Survivor Bill of Rights. And they some of these ideas have come from them and looked at, you know, is this something we need to do in Alaska? In House Bill 31 last year, we put in the victim-centered approach, so it allows an individual after a sexual assault to have two options for submitting the kit. One is called an anonymous report, and it allows them to have the evidence collected because it's time sensitive and needs to be done within 72 hours. We just learned about a case yesterday that was thrown out of court before because they said that it wasn't collected in a timely enough fashion. So it's really important that takes place. But because of the trauma associated with the sexual assault, sometimes an individual at that time doesn't want to make the decision about moving forward with the criminal piece of that and working with law enforcement and going through the court. So the anonymous report allows them to have the evidence collected but be able to make the decision at a future time. And then the other option is the law enforcement report. And then that is for an individual who, at the time that the kit is collected, has decided, you know, they want to move forward with the prosecution and engage with law enforcement. It also requires training for all law enforcement professionals on sexual assault response. Prior to House Bill 31, the statute just required training on domestic violence, and so wanted to make sure that our law enforcement professionals have training on both of those. The pieces that were not included and are the part of House Bill 20 are a timeline established for testing and then victim notification once the testing has occurred. But I just want to give that context of all the pieces we've kind of been trying to click through and make improvements, and I think we can all feel proud that of the work that's happened over the last few years, because we really have made some significant improvements in the way our system works. And so in the bill, I'm going to skip over sections 1, 2, and 3 and go to section 4 because that is the section related to the sexual assault examination kits. And so just so we keep that kind of the thinking all together. And so what we want to address with this bill is establishing the timeline for when the kits have to be tested and then victim notification. Because one of the things we learned when we started working on this is that some of the untested kits were years old, multiple years old, even one, and this is unusual, but more than a decade old. And so if you're the individual, you know how the court system can be, that there's delays in prosecution and there's, you know, often a court doesn't go to trial when it's supposed to because there's another kind of delay in that process. And what has happened over time is that sometimes these kits will not be tested until the case is going to trial, and that could be a couple years from the incident. That's really hard on a victim because they're just wondering and there's no certain sort of certainty to that process. So what we establish here is that the sexual assault examination kits have to be sent to the crime lab within 30 days of collection. So we want to have a process for that. We've reached out to law enforcement throughout the state to make sure that that's something that's not overburdensome. Talked to the Barrow Police Department. We've talked to the troopers. We've talked to APD. Everyone says that's a good standard that we can adopt and feel good about. That all sexual assault examination kits will be tested within 1 year. When we first started working on this, it was taking on average 18 months. We have reduced that down to in the 10-month-a-year time frame. We would like to get to a place where that 1 year becomes 6 months, and then that 6 months becomes 30 days. But we need to keep working through this process to sort of build up our capacity to accomplish that. So 1 year is really where they're at right now. So it, in terms of what it means on the crime lab side of things, that seems reasonable. And we worked with them and changed it from 6 months to a year for that reason. But we want to have some certainty for that. So now, you know, if an individual has experienced a sexual assault, they know, you know, when the kit was collected, they know when it's going to go to the crime lab, they know within which time it's going to be tested, and then finally that the victim will be notified by law enforcement within 2 weeks that the testing has been complete. And so that way they have some certainty to that whole process that can sort of make sure that they're not re-traumatized over and over, because one of the really unfortunate things that happens throughout these cases is if an individual wants to know what's going on and they call the police department, they have to retell the story over and over and get transferred from this person to that person, and each time it just further traumatizes the victim. So by building in a system where they know when things are going to happen, then we can remove some of that difficulty that they go through in this process. I'll say that one version of the bill actually, I'm sorry.
We have a question from Representative Knopf.
Okay.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So the 2 weeks, so this means they could take a year to test it, and then they have 2 weeks from the time it's tested. So the victim may have to wait up to a year, maybe longer, to even be notified, though, huh? But they should expect that within a year's time they should have heard.
Through the chair to Representative Knopf, yes, that's true. And right now there's no timeline for that, so there's no way to know when that might be happening, and that's why we want to do that. And we checked with them just to make sure, law enforcement that is, that, you know, how long does it take once the kit has been tested for you to receive that information, and is 2 weeks reasonable? And they said that was something that was doable, again, when we talked to multiple different law enforcement agencies.
So follow up. So when they test the kit, do they get the results back immediately, or did it take a while to get results back from the tester?
Through the chair to Representative Knopf, it depends right now, for example, because we had a backlog, those ones are being sent out of state. And one thing we're trying to do with strengthening the capacity of the crime lab is make sure that everything's happening in state. The recent cases are all happening in state, and we want to keep it that way. So that's why, you know, making sure that the timelines actually work for the staffing that we have is what we want to do right now, if that makes sense. I hope that makes sense.
So is there a database to where, as they're testing them, that if somebody is reoffending, so let's say someone, you know, for whatever reason doesn't want to go forward, and but yet you already, they have the evidence, and they test that evidence, does it just, you know, sit in kind of its own little cubicle if that person doesn't want to prosecute, Or is there a database where if somebody else gets harmed, that some way they can see whether or not that person has been involved in another potential crime?
Madam Chair, as I understand it, right now, if they choose to do the anonymous report, that kit is not going to be tested until such time as they choose to have it tested. There are circumstances if the, and we tried to sort of understand all the details to this, and I think it's not one of those sort of, there could be case by case kind of examples, if you will, but I have been told there are times when the state, and maybe as a former prosecutor, Representative Josephson will want to add in, will move forward in a Jane Doe capacity. And so in that circumstance, if they're like what you're suggesting, that there's evidence that it may be the same perpetrator of more than one crime, I think that may be a circumstance where they would, in fact, want to move forward and then try to find a way that they could move forward with evidence but not require the participation of the victim from that first case.
So there's no mechanism right now where I can say, I don't want to move forward, but I also don't want it to happen to someone else. So if somebody wants to test it, to have that on file, I'm okay with that, even though I'm not going to move forward. So that currently is not an option for the victim.
Through Madam Chair, that's a little bit of a nuance to the situation. In that circumstance, the survivor is saying, yes, you can test my kit. And so we should probably, you know, have somebody maybe from Department of Law go into a little more detail on this. But as I understand it, you know, that may be a circumstance where they would move forward with the testing, but it's a little bit different because, in fact, the individual is giving permission, but they're trying to change their participation in that. But maybe could be convinced by the, you know, scenario that you're suggesting of a person who's been involved in more than one crime.
And we'll have public safety with us this weekend, so we'll bring that back up again.
Okay.
To make sure, because I do know there may be individuals who might not want to move forward with their case,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I would hope that there would be some kind of mechanism mm-hmm. so that if somebody is a multiple offender, mm-hmm. just because somebody was scared and didn't want to do it, would make it a first offense, which when it could be third or fourth. So we'll make mm-hmm. sure that this weekend we have them here to have that discussion.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add, so in for your discussion, take the Justin Schneider case that we've talked so much about in this session. You know, one of the things that they said was hard about moving that case forward was losing contact with the victim, because then when it goes into the courtroom, right, there's that's like a he said, she said, but there's nobody to defend that side of the story. So I think it's kind of those circumstances, because when we first started working on this, we wanted to say that every kit had to be tested no matter what, for the very reason that you're talking about, thinking, you know, we don't want to miss any opportunity if this is a dangerous person that we would have this evidence. But at the same time, the U.S. Department of Justice put out a white paper that talked about how when you do these reforms, you want to make sure you have a victim-centered approach. And so that's why we put in the anonymous versus the law enforcement. But what advocates will say, and there's going to be people who talk behind me, is that a lot of times when an individual chooses the anonymous report initially, they later choose to go forward. It's just that the overwhelming experience of what has had just happened, and then if people don't know what happens, if they're lucky enough to have had this is a strange way to sort of preface it, but happen in a community like Anchorage where there's a SART team, then the SART team, the sexual assault response team, has a SANE, a sexual assault nurse examiner, a police officer, an advocate, so that they only have to tell the story once. And we have a very fragmented system for the SART teams, just 6 communities in Alaska have them right now. So again, you know, depending on where you live, you might not have that. And so it could be a much more difficult experience that might involve going to a hospital and talking to police and talking to an advocate. And so the overall experience could be so overwhelming that you choose at that time not to move forward with the law enforcement.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay.
Continue.
Thank you. So those are the big pieces of this in terms of establishing those timelines. And then we had previously put in the audit report, and we've received 2 audits. Every member of the legislature should have received that, and I think it's in the most recent ones in the bill packet, I believe. Very important information. It's helping us understand what's happening with the backlog and the prosecutions and further improvements to the system. Working with some advocates, there was interest in understanding a little bit more about why some of the kits weren't tested. So then these sections add in some language that says that you know, we want to know these three things. And the SAKI, the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, these are the categories that they're using. And so by using the same categories, it's, you know, the apples to apples kind of information. So they want to know if it wasn't tested because it wasn't collected improperly, or is not tested necessary to identify the perpetrator of the crime, or was collected from a person who does not wish to proceed. That 19, pardon me, is like a typo there with criminal charges. And that number two is important because when we started working on this, one of the things we learned was that sometimes the kits weren't tested because in that particular instance, the identity of the individuals involved was known. What was in question was consent. And so was it a consensual sexual interaction, but it wasn't the identity. And so, you know, if that were the reason that it wasn't tested before, then that would indicate that. But what's really sort of changing the landscape of understanding of these crimes is in a lot of the states where they've done the testing, they're finding many more serial offenders than they expected. And for example, I want to say it was in Detroit, when they tested their kits, they found hits, if you will, call them hits in the DNA database in 39 other states. And so, you know, people move around a lot and may have committed a crime in one state and another. And so I think it'll be very instructive as we go forward to learn more about this, and this will be an important addition. The folks said it, you know, wouldn't be administratively difficult to integrate these additional items into the audit report that they're already preparing.
And if I may, Stephanie Andrew, for the record, the language has changed a little bit too in this portion of it in the most recent version of the bill. Just to say the criterion are one, that the kit is scientifically unviable; two, does not meet eligibility requirements for the inclusion in the CODIS database; or three, was collected from a person who wishes to remain anonymous. So those are, it's the same concept as what Representative Tarr was discussing from the first draft, but this is the language that was used by the Department of Public Safety in their report to the legislature. And so that's why we changed it to match that.
Thank you for the explanation.
So those are the parts of the bill that relate to the sexual assault examination kits. And then if we're okay with that, I'll go back to sections 1, 2, and 3. And if you can pull up that document, the STAR priorities. And we'll have Keely from STAR as a public testifier, and then Carmen from Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. So they're much more knowledgeable than I am on these. But number one policy priority, rename sexual assault in the second degree to sexual contact with or penetration of an incapacitated person. And this number one is really related to number two, although number two we're kind of dealing with separately, and hopefully a lot of people will be involved in this, rewriting the consent definition. But the consent definition in our statute right now suggests that force has to be used. And so you have these circumstances where a person is incapacitated, and so there's no visible signs of force. When those cases go before a jury, the jury is often left thinking that wasn't a sexual assault because they're not seeing visible signs of force. And so they wanted to strengthen this definition for sexual assault in the second degree to address that. This suggestion here was rejected by Ledge Legal because sexual assault in the second degree has more than just the piece about interaction with an incapacitated person. So they didn't want to redefine the whole category of sexual assault in the second degree, but instead update the language. And so if you look in the bill, and actually this is in three sections, so it's sexual assault in the first degree, second degree, and third degree. It takes out the words "the offender knows" in a few different places here. And so by removing those words, for example, if we're just looking on page 1, lines 13 and 14, the offender engages in sexual penetration with another person who is mentally incapable. And so who the offender knows, by taking it out, the default for our standard, the default mental state for the penal code that we've adopted in Alaska is the reasonable person standard. So the suggestion was this would clean it up because the default then is what a reasonable person should know. So you're not sort of giving a gray area about how much they knew or didn't know, but just You know, the offender engages in sexual penetration with another person who, right, we're taking out this because that's the default position, is that what a reasonable person would know, so who is mentally incapable. And again, the suggestion in the STAR priorities, the perpetrator may be found guilty of the offense if they know or reasonably should know that the victim is incapacitated or unaware and unable to consent to sexual penetration or sexual contact under the circumstances. So this actually got quite a bit of attention because we put it into this bill, and it also was added in Senate Judiciary to Senate Bill 35. And so Mr. Skidmore, this came through, like, sort of there are about three or four different iterations of what this language might look like to accomplish what is in this priority. And this is what everyone has landed on, is the cleanest version and easy, sort of cleanest, most clear way to address that, to tighten it up. So that, again, is repeated in Section 1 for sexual assault in the first degree, Section 2 for second degree, and then SA3 in Section 3. And with that, that completes the introduction to the bill. And again, I know that we have folks from STAR and the network, and both of them can speak to that a little bit more, because what is so great about working with them is they're seeing, you know, the day-to-day interpretation of our laws and how they're working and not working. So I really look to them for guidance on how to do this right and address some of the errors. And so I think we've been able to address one of those. And like I say, hopefully on the second piece with the definition of consent, the Judiciary Chair, Senator Hughes, and I have started working on that, and I think it's gonna has some very far-reaching implications for how we address sexual assault, and so we hope to be talking to you about that at a later time.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And we do have some invited testimony. We'll be doing public testimony tomorrow at 3:30. But with that, we're going to have invited testimony, and we have Carmen Lowry. Would you like to come up and put yourself on the record? Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Carmen Lowry, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I'm here today, first of all, I want to say thank you all for providing us this opportunity to share our perspectives, to participate in this. It's a wonderful thing to do, so thank you very much. The network is comprised of 24 community-based organizations that provide direct life-saving services, most of them providing shelter to victims and survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. We have been talking about this bill extensively for a long time, particularly because Reptar has been involved in the Saki Initiative. So the Saki Initiative is an initiative that was supported by the state to really look at the backlog of sexual assault kits. We want to thank Representative Tarr for her leadership and thank her for reaching out and allowing for us to participate. I want to say that for us, this bill, one of the things that stands out in this bill is about how victim-centered it is and how it allows for victims to be very clear on what's going to happen. So you can see this in the sections where we start talking about the time frames. So the time frames are clearly outlined. You have the kit goes to the crime lab. The crime lab has a certain amount of time that's in law that they have to test. Law enforcement has a certain amount of time, then they need to get the information back. Knowing that, having that structure, having those parameters is critical to allow a victim to understand that I'm being treated with respect, that my kit is being treated with respect. And I also want to go back to what Rep. Tarr brought up about the anonymous testing. And just to really help you all think about, if someone has been sexually assaulted and they've gone to the hospital to get a sexual assault exam, sometimes it's really difficult to make what will be a life-altering decision to move forward with reporting. And we're just thrilled that victims can go, anyone can go, you can get health care, which everyone has to have health care, They can have a trained medical provider to say, this is what a forensic exam looks like. You could have an advocate there. And then you could say, you don't have to make that decision right now. You can make it a bit later. Because once a victim gets connected, usually with a victim advocate, she or he will continue to engage in the process. So again, I just want to say thank you very much. We want to say thank you to Representative Tarr and to all of you all for hearing and for your willingness to listen to me and to listen on behalf of victims. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here. And with that, online we have Carly Wells. Carly, if you could put yourself on the record, you can begin your testimony.
Hi, I'm sorry about that. Hi, my name is Carly Wells, and I am in Fairbanks, Alaska. I work with sexual assault victims, and I can't stress enough how powerful and necessary it is to pass HB 20. As you know, Alaska is the highest in the nation for sexual assault, and we're in the middle of an epidemic, and I see it every single day. The healing journey for victims is long and painful and difficult, so passing this would give some level of dignity back to them, for them to know a time frame on when their kit would be tested, not just afraid it's sitting somewhere on a shelf with no one caring to move forward. Also, having a year time frame would give the victim some peace of mind to know they won't be getting called four or five or more years later with the results, which happens often to many victims nationwide and can seriously derail them in their journey. Passing this bill does not bring excess cost in getting the kits tested, and is showing how much we as a state care about victims and getting justice for them in a reasonable time frame. For the sake of the victims, give them back some dignity, some sense and security in knowing, because the rape itself stripped them of all of that. As someone who hears their stories day in and day out, I can tell you this bill is necessary and incredibly needed in our state. The amount of victims I have that ask me if it will even matter to go through this exam, which can be incredibly traumatic and incredibly reviolating, to not even know if it will matter in the long run, if their kit will never be tested or tested so far down the road. I cannot stress enough how important this would be for me to be able to say to them, and for everyone to be able to say to them, here's a time frame that you can think about this in terms of a year out instead of an unknown time. Because for an unknown time for a rape victim, it's so incredibly traumatic and makes that healing process even longer. So I just ask you to please pass this bill. It's so incredibly important in our state, so necessary and so needed. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Online, we've for questions, we have David Canaris, who's the Assistant Chief of Forensic Laboratories for the Department of Public Safety. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Canaris? Seeing none, but thank you so much for being online today. So with that, we're going to set the bill aside and thank Representative Tarr for being here. We will have other agencies here tomorrow and continue work on this important bill on this weekend. And with that, we're going to move along to a presentation that we have now from Dr. Payne, who's the Associate Director of the Alaska Justice Information Center through the university. And are you online, sir?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and we're going to get your presentation up here in just one moment. We're going to take a quick at ease while we get the presentation up.
Sure.
We're back on the record. Dr. Payne, if you please put yourself on the record, and we have your presentation before us.
My name is Troy Payne. I am an associate director of the Alaska Justice Information Center, and I'm an associate professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center.
Okay, go ahead.
So today we're going to talk about an analysis that we here at the Alaska Justice Information Center have been doing on arrest data that we've received from the Department of Public Safety. Before I do that, I want to tell you a little bit about the Alaska Justice Information Center and about the UAA Justice Center, just in case there are folks in the room who don't know who we are. The Alaska Justice Information Center was established in 2015 to compile, analyze, and report on criminal justice topics to policymakers and practitioners. And our role is to provide impartial data analysis to policymakers and to the general public. The Alaska Justice Information Center is a unit within the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center, and we are an academic and research unit. We're an academic department here at UAA. So we have academic programs in criminal justice and legal studies and a wide variety of faculty research on top of that. The analysis that I'm presenting today, moving on to slide two, is using as a data source data that's required by AS 4419645. Now, that statute requires that agencies report certain individually identified data to the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. And I believe you've got the Judicial Council on a bit later to talk about some more of that, so I'll sort of skip over that. But among those data that are required to be reported to the commission are arrest and citation data as collected by the Department of Public Safety and recorded in the arrest history repository for the state. So that data, moving on to the slide three, that data has charge level information on all felony arrests and felony citations, all misdemeanor arrests and misdemeanor citations, covering a period beginning in July of 2014 through the end of the calendar year of 2018. It's important to note here that what's not included in the analysis that I'm about to tell you about, we do not have infractions, violations, and there's a small number of instances where there can be charges without an arrest tracking number, and those are not going to appear in these data either. So moving on to slide four, trying to move pretty quickly through the nerdy bits here in the interest of time. What we get from the Department of Public Safety is a big table with a whole bunch of columns. There's one record or one row per charge. So we've got this big table that's got 220,000 some charges between the beginning of July 2014 and the end of December 2018. We're only using a handful of fields for the analysis that I'm talking about today. We're using the absent ID. That is the Alaska Public Safety Identification Number. That's the identification number that uniquely identifies a person. And so it's sort of like a Social Security number, but for interactions with the criminal justice system. We're looking at the arrest date and the arrest statute just a little bit, and that arrest tracking number, which is a unique number that's attached to each arrest.
So do we know how many people, the 222,313 charges, do we know how many individuals committed those charges?
So I can get that number. I don't have it top of mind, but I can follow up to give you that number.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Sure. Let me make a note of that before I immediately forget it.
Representative LeBon.
As a follow-up to that, thank you, Madam Chair. Repeat offenders to include multiple, two, three, four, not just once.
So we're asking for two things.
So we are the Alaska Justice Information Center is actively working these data. What I would encourage you to do, if there are further questions on this, we can respond to those requests. So we have to kind of figure out exactly what it is that we're looking at, because it is a fair amount of data. But we're happy to answer a variety of requests related to these analyses.
You may continue.
So we're now on to slide five. What we're looking at in this analysis is how many people are rearrested within a short period of time. So given that someone has been arrested today, are they arrested again within the next 7 days? That's the analysis that we're presenting today. We sort of are trying to get the broadest picture possible of folks who are having multiple engagements with the criminal justice system in a very, very short period of time. The way that we do that is that we calculate the number of days between an arrest and the next arrest for that person. We determine whether that is 7 days or less, and then we count the number of people who are rearrested for every week. And we're going to plot that on a chart that I'll show you here in the next slide. So slide six starts with that chart construction. And what you'll see on that chart is it starts with just one dot on it, which will have the number of people who are arrested in that week and then rearrested within the next 7 days. So if we advance that slide, what should happen is an animation should play where each one of those weeks, the number of folks who are arrested in that week gets plotted on that chart. As we move forward in time, we see that we've got this scatter of points over time. So we're looking at the number of people who are rearrested within 7 days of an initial arrest over time. This chart is showing really not a lot of difference in the period that we have in this data prior to criminal justice reform, so that is from July of 2014 through to July of 2016, and the period in between criminal justice reform, so SB 91 and SB 54, and in the period after SB 54. So we've got this variation, but there's not that much difference in the period prior to criminal justice reform compared to the period after criminal justice reform. Moving to the next slide, this is just a different view of the same information. Instead of all of the dots plotted here, we plotted data analysts would call a local polynomial smooth line. So instead of having all the dots to look at, we just have a line. And that helps to reinforce this idea that there's not a lot of movement of that line. So the line is at the same point prior to criminal justice reform as it is after criminal justice reform. There's just not a lot of difference prior to criminal justice reform compared to after.
So would our issue still be that people are getting out and within 7 days are reoffending? So is that still obviously an issue that we have not resolved?
Yeah, you know, I think that the way that the way that I interpret this is that this phenomenon of folks being arrested and then arrested again within a relatively short period of time is very real. And when we hear reports of this from law enforcement and from prosecutors, it's a real phenomenon that occurs. The question that we were seeking to answer is whether there was a difference in the number of folks for whom that's true prior to criminal justice reform compared to after. And what we're seeing from this analysis, at least in the data that we have access to through the Criminal Justice Commission, is that there's not a difference after criminal justice reform compared to before. So to the extent that this is a problem, it has been a problem, at least going back to July of 2014, and it has not become a worse problem after criminal justice reform.
And we have a question from Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you to the chair. I'm just trying to understand your data here. So back in page 4, you had roughly 222 plus charges between the period of 2014 and 2018. Your fields, are your fields the public safety number? Is that an individual number? In other words,
through the chair, yes, it is.
Okay. And so, and the arrest tracking number, so that arrest tracking number goes with the Alaska Public Safety ID number?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay, so this is how you, so when you're doing queries, I'm just sorry to go back to this, but I wanted to understand what data we were looking at. So that's how you arrive at these queries as far as what's happening with 7 days, is that you have, you can track what that person that was arrested that received the public safety number did through the tracking number as far as within a week's time. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. So we are able to say that a particular individual person was arrested on a date, and we have another record for them when they're arrested on another date, and we're able to take the difference between those two dates. That is correct.
Okay, I needed to understand, thank you for that, because with the large number of charges, it is relatively easy to understand how many people are involved in this because of the ID number.
But following with Representative Johnston and then looking at whether we're looking at the line or we're looking at the dots, if before we're saying because of the tool that corrections has been utilizing, we're letting people out and they're just reoffending, if I go by what you're saying, we were doing that already. So is that a true analysis?
Madam Chair, you know, I don't know that I would, I don't know that I would characterize it that way. That extends pretty far outside of the data that I have. This is kind of narrow slice that I'm looking at. What I can say is that the number of people who are arrested and then arrested again within the next 7 days has stayed relatively constant over the time period that we have data for.
Is that the data let me ask you a little different. So where on this chart would corrections have begun the tool where we were supposedly allowing more people to stay out of jail? Wouldn't that have started around January 2018?
Madam Chair, that is a complicated question to answer. So the short answer is that January 2018 is when the Department of Corrections started using the pretrial risk assessment tool.
Correct. So that's
That pretrial risk assessment tool, which, for the record, I'm also revalidating as part of separate analyses that are not yet completed, but we are taking a look at the predictive accuracy of that tool. That tool began being used in January of 2018. I believe there were some reforms to pretrial detention practices that occurred in 2016, and then there were also roughly at the same time changes to the bail schedule that's set within the court system. So there were a lot of changes to pretrial detention that occurred kind of all at the same time. It's very difficult to attribute causation to any one of those.
Well, we're getting ready to do a crime bill, and the issue right now, and I think we all wrote down what our priorities were. They'd be probably all over the board. And one of my frustrations is not having the right kind of data. But if I just look at this data on the rearrest every 7 days, with the changes that we have made between before the criminal justice reform, between the criminal justice reform and SB 54, now after SB 54, the line really hasn't moved. So it still appears that we have an issue with those who are obviously gotten arrested, broke the law again within 7 days, because that's what this shows. And if we had maybe done the right thing,
we would have, I would have thought that somewhere in this line, we would have started seeing it go, start going down. And I'm agreeing with you. It looks like it's exactly the same. So what am I misunderstanding?
Madam Chair, this is, you know, our analysis here is relatively limited. I mean, we're looking at a very narrow slice. But to the extent that if we had, for example, more folks being released pre-trial, we might expect there to be more people who get rearrested. So, you know, I think there are a couple of different ways of interpreting this. But if we're releasing more people pre-trial, it's not impacting this particular measure that we're looking at here. It is a quite complicated issue, though, because of the number of changes that have been implemented in a relatively short period of time, and, you know, frankly, the very different approach to pretrial detention that's been used throughout the state. You know, the Pretrial Enforcement Division didn't really start operating until January of 2018. That's a pretty large difference from prior practice, but it hasn't really impacted this number of people who've been rearrested.
Okay, so before I go to Representative Johnston, so maybe help us understand why you even showed us this graph then, if we can't take any information from it, and it's too complicated for us to understand.
Madam Chair, that's not how I would characterize it. I certainly would not characterize it as being too complicated. I think that the trying to attribute cause for any of this is what's difficult. The reason that we would be interested in sharing results from an analysis like this is to ensure that policymakers have the relevant information that they need to make policy. And again, you know, to the extent that the state of Alaska is releasing more people pre-trial, if the claim is that more folks are being arrested in a short period of time afterwards, that's not what we're seeing in these data that are available to us.
Okay, well, we have more questions. So we can't make good policy if we don't understand the cause. But Representative Johnston, take a shot at this.
Yes, through the chair. And I have to say, when I was thinking of this question, I then went whipping through to see if it was answered later on. But is there any difference in the number of people arrested during these times? I mean, this is a span of 4 years. Was there a concentration of arrests in any one of these periods of time, or did that make any difference? I mean, am I making any sense?
Through the chair, yes, that makes sense. We did not look at that. So I'm trying to think if we did look at that. This particular analysis doesn't look at the number of people arrested in general over time. It looks specifically at folks who were arrested within this, you know, short window that we're looking at, within 7 days, in the slide number 7. We could look at the number of people arrested per week over time. We certainly have the data to do that, and I could follow up with you to give you those numbers.
That'd be great, because I think you should be able to query this, because you have the individual people, and it could make some of this make sense.
Good luck. Okay, Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How would the study capture an individual who is rearrested on the same day?
Through the chair, that is a great question. And the answer to that question is someone who is rearrested on the same day is counted as having been rearrested. So if they are arrested on a new arrest tracking number on the same day, that is counted as a new arrest. That's counted as a rearrest.
Follow-up?
The ATN number is tied to a particular arrest event, does that change or remain the same on a rearrest on the same day?
Through the chair, my understanding is that the arrest tracking number should be unique to the arrest event.
Follow up?
And then the last question at the moment would be the geographic distribution of the rearrests, as in my understanding is Anchorage was suffering, or South Central Alaska was suffering from a lot of rearrests. Does the data show geographic distribution?
Through the chair, it's another great question. We can look at the arresting agency, and that would be as close as we could get to geographic distribution, but we have not done so for the analysis that I'm talking about today.
Very good. You may continue.
Okay, so I think we're on slide 7. So moving then to slide 8. We can go ahead and skip to slide 11. So far, what we have been talking about excluded violations of conditions of release. On slide 11, I show what this looks like when we include VCOR, violations of conditions of release. The reason that VCOR was excluded in the prior slides was that in the period in between SB 91 and SB 54, violations of conditions of release were not a crime. They were a violation. The data that I have only includes felonies and misdemeanors. It does not include violations. So in that period when violations of conditions of release were not a misdemeanor or a felony, they disappear from the data set. So if we don't subtract them out from the entire data series, what you get is a line that looks like it drops for a period in between July 2016 and November of 2017. But in the interest of completeness, I've added that in here to slide 11 so that you can see what it would look like if we had violations of conditions of release in there. The overall story is pretty much the same. We've got this, gap in between criminal justice reform and SB 54, where violations of conditions of release disappear from my data source. But otherwise, it's the same story. That there's not a large difference prior to criminal justice reform compared to after criminal justice reform. But that, that's there because we did have to remove VCOR, and I wanted to ensure that the committee understood how that worked. So if we move on to slide 12, the overall summary here is that each week, statewide, There are about 26 people, roughly an average of 26 people, who are rearrested within 7 days of an initial arrest. We see in these data no evidence of a change in that number before criminal justice reform compared to after criminal justice reform. That's relatively constant across the entire data series. And I won't really belabor the point, but if in your briefing books, you'll see additional slides where I looked at time periods both a little bit shorter than and quite a bit longer than 7 days. So I looked at 3 days, 7 days, 10, 14, 30, 60, 90, and 180 days. And the number of arrests changes, the scale of the vertical axis changes, but the overall story doesn't. That the number of people who are rearrested within whatever time window I'm looking at is more or less constant before criminal justice reform compared to after criminal justice reform. So overall, the numbers stay relatively the same, and that is pretty consistent no matter what time frame I'm looking at. So that was one of the concerns that we had when we started doing this analysis, is that maybe 7 days was too long or too short of a period to look at, and it just doesn't matter how long the follow-up period is. It looks the same prior to criminal justice reform compared to after criminal justice reform.
So based on this summary, that would be 1,352 crimes in a year time just by these rearrests within the 7 days. So as we're looking at what a crime bill should have in it, how do we make it to where we're not having 26 people rearrested within 7 days or 3 days? It still seems like there's a pretty big issue here. What is the solution with the data that you have seen?
Madam Chair, so two things. One, I could get you that total number of arrests. I am pretty good at statistics and data analysis. I am pretty bad at doing them on the fly in this sort of setting, but I could get you that total number if you were interested in it. Our role is to provide an analysis of the data. We're not looking at any particular policy solutions here. I do think that it is notable that to the extent that there were changes made by SB 91 and by the other associated reform bills since then, there's not been much of movement in this particular measure that we're looking at in this presentation today. So while it hasn't gotten better, it also hasn't gotten worse. And there may be other benefits from the policies that have been pursued in the time period since. You know, again, we're looking at this one fairly narrow measure trying to determine the extent to which this is a problem and really the extent to which that it has changed after criminal justice reform.
Okay, we have a question from Representative Johnston, followed by Representative Knopp. Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you to the chair. As far as the violations and conditions of release, the change between before SB 91 and then after SB 54, there seems to be some changes in that data and maybe even a slight increase, but it also seems like it's almost like it's required a ramping up in all of these graphs. Do you have any thoughts on why that was, or does it mean that there were actually larger violations, conditions of release, or people were becoming more familiar with it?
Through the chair, Representative, I could offer only speculation on that. I would note that that's roughly coincident with the standing up of the pretrial enforcement division. So it's possible that has some impact there. The VCOR numbers do tend to stabilize over time, so they increase a bit post SB 54. And tend to find an equilibrium that's at roughly the same rate as it was prior to reform. But there is a much shorter period after SB 54. So I don't know how much I would read into that.
Thank you.
Representative Knopp.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I'll just go on record as saying that I do not recall everything in 91. And I don't recall what we did in SB 4 other than some fixes to 91. And as everybody recalls, 91 was phased in. It all didn't get implemented in the same time frame. But your material, your data, clearly to me shows no change before or after. So you're correct. It didn't lead to more or less rearrest under your data, if I interpreting what you're saying. But what I'm wondering is part of the reason we went to justice reform, it was the cost of incarceration and actually incarceration of people who have yet to stand trial. One of the reasons we did crime reform. So I think, if anything, I'm wondering, we have the rearrest, so I'm wondering what to take away from the data. Did we reduce any cost and incarceration in that time frame. It's looking to me like it's a status quo from, if I'm interpreting what you're telling me. Is that fair to say?
Through the chair, Representative Knopp, is not part of this analysis. So we're not looking at the extent to which any of these folks have been arrested or being detained. That would require linking Department of Corrections data through to arrest data, and that is a technically surprisingly complicated task.
Okay, so just want to follow up with a question then.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you. So I guess what I'm looking for, is there anything that you can tell me that we've made gains in since the crime reform, 91, 54? Does your data show anything that shows us we've made some progress, either in reducing cost or in incarceration rates or rearrest? I think that's what I'm looking for. Is there anything you have that can lead me that direction?
Through the chair, Representative, not in this analysis. The Judicial Council, I believe, is scheduled to talk to you about some of the broader implications of criminal justice reform. And so they may be able to address that question. This analysis that I'm speaking to was on a very narrow question of the extent to which folks are being rearrested within a short period of time. So hopefully the Judicial Council would be able to answer that question more fully.
Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it.
And with that, thank you, Dr. Payne. We're out of time for this particular presentation. We're going to go to the next presentation. Suzanne DiPietro. We have the Criminal Justice Reform in Alaska presentation before us. You've kind of heard some of the questions that we have, and you may put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Suzanne DiPietro. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council, and I'm coming to you in the capacity of the Alaska Judicial Council serving as staff to the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. And so the chair has asked me to talk about a couple of different things with you this afternoon. The first one is sort of, you know, just to remind you who's the commission, why do we have this data, and what are we doing with it, which I hope I'll be able to address some of Representative Knopp's concerns and questions. And then the second part is sort of, you know, sort of to take a look at, hey, we're getting this data. You know, what is it showing? You know, how are things going after reform, and how do those situations compare to the situation pre-reform? So I don't have much time, so I'm going to be moving pretty quickly. And please interrupt me if you want me to sort of go back a little bit or elaborate a little bit more on something. So skipping to slide 3. I want to this is just a list of the members of the Criminal Justice Commission that's set. Those membership is set in statute by you all. And I think the thing to take away from this slide is that the commission has membership from the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. And the idea behind the membership is to have the most sort of broad-ranging perspectives from the system, the criminal justice system, and even the Department of Health and Social Services, which isn't normally thought of too much as being a part of the criminal justice system. So the commission's work and recommendation, the commissioners direct the staff. They request the data they need to make any recommendations from staff, and staff does the analysis. On slide 4, I'll just remind you about a part of SB 91 that has been very helpful to the commission, and I hope to the legislature, with respect to data. So the commission is commanded to sort of look at what is happening with the recommendations that were made in 2015 and enacted into law with the various reform bills. And that information we've been tracking, the commission has been tracking since the reform passed. And we submit it to you all every November 1. If those reports somehow slipped through the email filter, they're posted on our website, and the commission's website is linked on the council's website. So you would just go to the Alaska Judicial Council website and scroll down just a little bit, and you can get the commission, get to their homepage, and there's a lot of information there. So headed on to slide number 5, I want to tell you just a little bit more about the data that the commission gets in order to answer the questions, how are we doing? So the court system gives us information about all charges that are disposed every quarter. Department of Public Safety gives us the citations, arrests, and charges every quarter. And that's, for example, the data that Dr. Payne was just talking about the analysis of. And then the Department of Corrections actually has a pretty heavy lift, and the Corrections provides the commission with a lot of different information related to pretrial outcomes, related to the prison population, getting a little bit to Representative Knopf's concern, and also related to probation and parole data. So we also get data from the parole board from Jeff Edwards, who I think you heard from earlier. And so that information is given quarterly. Moving on to slide six. And commission staff, in partnership with the Alaska Justice Information Center, analyzes the data. And we analyze it with an eye to answering the questions that are in the statute. And one of the things in the statute is recidivism data. So I think the question maybe underlying some of the discussion that I was hearing earlier is, hey, you know, what's happening with recidivism? And there's a couple of definitions of recidivism in the statute that the commission will be using, and we're actually going to collect even more data because we think it's an important topic for policymakers to understand. But the normal window for looking at recidivism is 3 years, and the reform was passed so recently that, you know, 3 years haven't really gone by yet. But we're keeping track of the information. You may have seen some recidivism data from the Department of Corrections, and that is excellent data. It is a little more limited than what the commission will be reporting. The commission is also going to be attempting to report recidivism data for misdemeanors. So those are a lot of those property offenders, for example, that we're all kind of concerned about. Also for felons. And the commission is looking pretty carefully at not just the recidivism rate of not just people who went to prison, but also individuals who were charged and convicted and maybe even didn't have a prison sentence or served all their time pretrial. So we want to provide, the commission wants to provide the most important, the most comprehensive information that it can. And I also want to point out to everyone on the committee and everyone really in the building that, you know, the information that the commission has is unique in the sense that we have information from three different agencies and we can knit it together in the way that Dr. Payne was talking about. So the commission has data that can offer a broader sometimes perspective than you can get from an individual agency. And we are happy and ready and excited to do analyses for members of the legislature. You know, the commission was created by you, and the commission serves you. So we want to give you the data that you need as much as we can, and we're happy to do analyses from interested stakeholders. I also want to just highlight real quickly a couple of reports that the legislature told the commission to publish, which it has. A report on restitution posted on the website, a report on Title 28 offenses posted on the website. Those are those driving under the influence offenses in Title 28. And also the newest publication that we just released is a publication on sex offenses, which I think is really timely and has a lot of really good information in it. You might check that out on our website. So now to sort of the data analysis. And so I'm going to start out just with a really quick, I'm going to whiz through these first slides because it sounds like all of you all pretty well remember where we were before criminal justice reform and why we did what we did. And then I'll get into the sort of how we're doing. So on slide eight, these are the issues that the Criminal Justice Commission uncovered when it did the criminal justice assessment. And the assessment spanned information up to about 2014. And one of the main problems, as has been identified, was Alaska was really having some pretty unsustainable prison growth. The recidivism rate, in other words, the rate at which people went back to prison after they were released, was pretty high. And some of the most interesting, I think, information and studies that the commission did were studies on pretrial detention. finding out that, you know, the ability to be released pretrial is related to your ability to pay bail, and also uncovering racial disproportionalities in pretrial detention. So moving on to slide 9, this is just the chart that shows the prison growth over time. Moving on to slide 10, this shows the, you know, the expected increase as well in the cost of corrections. And these are inflation-adjusted numbers for Representative Johnston, who I think might be wondering that. And then moving on to slide 11.
So on number 10.
I'm sorry. I'm having a really hard time hearing Chair Wilson.
Okay, so we increased by 1,100 people, but our bill went up $200 million. Do you have any idea why there was such a big increase of dollars? I mean, because I'm looking at the prison growth that you had on one page from 4133 to 5,267, and it appears in, well, maybe I'm not using the same amount, 2005, but it looks like there was a lot bigger increase than there were the number of people. Do you know why it's increased so much, substantially more than how many people we're getting?
You know, I don't off the top of my head know. Certainly, I'm guessing one of the potential increases might have been that a new prison was built, and then that would have increased operating expenses. This chart does not include capital expenditures, so that would not, the prison itself wouldn't have been in there, but the operating costs might have gone up. And I don't know the rest of it. That would be a great question for the Department of Corrections, or else I could research it for you, too.
Thank you.
Slide 11, I think you all already know this, but I want to just remind us of the sort of, these are the evidence-based principles that the commission used when it made recommendations that later became a part of criminal justice reform. And these sort of foundational principles are built on, hundreds of studies that have been done nationally and also some in Alaska about what works and what doesn't work for people who have been arrested and charged with crimes. And so the first thing is, you know, the first principle is to focus prison beds on serious and violent offenders. The commission recommended strengthening supervision practices at DOC. The commission did a series of crime victim roundtables throughout the state and amassed a list of crime victim priorities posted on our website, and so recommended a lot of different priorities from those reports that went into the reform bill. The commission was very clear that we needed to implement evidence-based pretrial practices, and as you have noted, that began in January of 2018. And then, of course, the commission, you know, strongly recommended reinvesting in treatment, which the legislature did. The commission is also, by the way, keeping track. I'm not including it in this presentation, but the commission is also keeping track of what the reinvestment was in treatment and also in prevention programs every year, and what the state of Alaska has received in exchange for that investment. In other words, what were the programs invested in, and how many people went through them?
Okay, we have a question from Representative Josephson.
Through the chair for Ms. DiPietro, I'm going to ask you something, and I don't expect you to have the answer right there, but one thing that would be valuable. And I'm not necessarily giving this as homework unless you've sort of accumulated it. But if I could see on one sheet of paper the savings in 91 and the expenditures in 91. I've heard the number $30 million, but then $15 million was sort of reappropriated and, quote, stolen away from those funds for some other purpose. I just need to see that. And I, you know, part of this, Ms. DiPietro, I'm being lazy. I could go to the fiscal notes and sort of piece this together. But if somebody in the building has that, I sure would love to see it.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, actually that is one of the items that the legislature told the commission to report to you on. And so every year in its annual report on November 1, the commission has given you that information to the best of the commission's ability to ferret it out. And so I don't have those numbers right off the top of my head, but the commission has been tracking it ever since criminal justice reform went into effect. I'm not sure I'm super familiar with your reference to the reappropriation issue. We certainly could follow up on that. I'm not aware of a reappropriation, so that I wouldn't probably have satisfaction for you on that piece.
Okay, we have a question from Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at slide 11, the fourth bullet reads, implemented evidence-based pretrial practices. Could you help me understand what that means?
Yes, and I do have, through the chair, I do have a, actually, I think it might be the very next slide, that I'll go into that a little bit more. If I could move on to 13. So, what is evidence-based pretrial practices? First of all, the evidence-based phrase refers to use of an actuarial risk assessment tool, and the bottom line on these tools is that studies show that more accurate decisions on pretrial detention are made when you include information from a risk assessment tool than when you rely on professional judgment alone. And I just, you know, that's just the data out there. And so that is why the commission recommended that the pretrial decision making, that we could enhance it, make it more accurate, hopefully, by using this tool. The other piece of the pretrial reform was to create the pretrial enforcement division, which you know about. And I want to really highlight on the left-hand side in the before category. Before reform, the main way of most people had a money bail imposed upon them. And that creates a situation where people who have access to cash or to funds or to family with cash can get out, and people who don't have that access can't. And that goes in the category of things that kind of don't seem fair, but more importantly, how much money a person has doesn't appear to be related to their risk of pretrial failure. So why are we using money? That was the question. I want to also highlight the second to the last bullet point, which is that 37% of defendants who were released pretrial before reform were rearrested for a new offense. 37%. So, you know, I personally look at that number and I think, wow, I'd like to do better than 37%. That doesn't seem too good. And so that was one of the statistics that the commission had that it was trying to, you know, address. The other key piece of the prior practice was that judges imposed third-party custodian requirements on a lot of different defendants, and in the commission's research showed that imposition of a third-party custodian was very, very strongly associated with inability to be released pretrial. So then moving on to slide 15, and this goes back a little bit to the discussion that Dr. Payne was having about, you know, are more people being released pretrial after reform compared to before reform? And actually, so the Judicial Council, I want to be clear, has been doing a study of defendants who were released, you know, a few months after the pretrial reform provisions and the PED went into effect. And that actually, unfortunately, it was even before HB 312. So the council has gathered a bunch of case files and has been studying those defendants and following those defendants and trying to figure out who got released and who didn't, what bail conditions were imposed on them. You know, has anything changed? That was the question that the council was trying to answer. And I have to tell you right off the bat that we don't have a complete answer yet because not enough time has gone by for those people's cases to be resolved. So we still have quite a few people from that file sample of around 400 files who are just still in the pretrial stage. And so I want to be cautious about giving this data, but it just seems like this is such an important issue that we should at least tell you what we know so far. And so it does look, you'll see on the right-hand side, it does look as though more defendants are being released during the pretrial period after reform than before. And the figure from before was about half. So about half of the defendants before reform were not released before their case was resolved. Now it looks like it's closer to maybe 69 or 70% who are released by judges. Also, we're noticing that fewer money bonds are being used. So before, about 69% of defendants had a money bond imposed. That means you have to actually put up money. And about 41% have that condition in the sample that we're studying. Also, way fewer third-party custodians, and of course that's related to the fact that if there are PED officers available to supervise a person, a third-party custodian is not authorized. What we are seeing is a big increase in the use of unsecured bonds. So an unsecured bond is you promise to pay money in the event that you mess up pretrial. So for a secured money bond or a money bond, you have to pay the money up front to get out. But for an unsecured bond, you pay it if you fail. Why did we do that? All the research shows that actually, believe it or not, secured money bonds are equally as effective at ensuring the appearance of the defendant as compared to secured money bonds. But of course, with an unsecured bond, people are more easily able to get out. Also, another interesting finding of this study so far, again, this could change, but about half of the defendants in our study were assigned to PED supervision, suggesting that, that's a lot of work for PED, and it looks as though they're being PED is being used quite heavily by the courts to supervise people released pretrial. So then on slide 15, you'll see that we are trying to get at this issue of ethnic disparities. And again, this is a cautionary presentation, but the Judicial Council has done a couple of different studies documenting ethnic disparities in the pretrial detention situation. So the situation is that if you are Alaska Native, you are more likely to be detained than if you are Caucasian. And the first time the Judicial Council documented that in a very robust study was in, like, 2004. And we did another study in 2015. Again, this was the pre-reform looking at the system and found similar ethnic disparities with about 26% of Natives being released compared to about 55% of Caucasians. And remember, the total figure was about half of all people were being released pretrial. So now we're looking at the 2018 sample. And again, I want to caution the committee, please, that, you know, the study's not completely final yet, but it does look as though people who are, if you look at everyone who's arrested, who is arrested in this study, it does look as though the disparities between Alaska Natives and Caucasians have decreased quite a bit. Some of you who have a head for numbers may notice that the percentages of people being released are different on this slide. Remember, I've been saying it was about 50%. There's a little bit of a problem with the comparison situation because another thing that changed that was not a part of criminal justice reform but that has complicated our ability to analyze the pretrial situation is that the bail schedule changed. And so people are also being released on the bail schedule, but we can't compare people released on the bail schedule now to people released on the bail schedule before. We don't have the data. We don't have the right kind of data. So if you look at everybody released after arrest, whether by the bail schedule or after being seen by a judge, it's a higher number than that earlier figure I gave you. So that's the difference. And I'm sorry that that's so complicated, and I'd be happy to follow up with anyone who thinks that I botched that explanation. Okay. Moving on to 16. The question is, well, we may be releasing more people, but are they being arrested more? And Dr. Payne's analysis is, I would argue, an important data point on that question. I don't think we've gotten that question answered yet, but we're working on it. So So we are, as I mentioned, the Judicial Council is tracking some cases, and also the Justice Center, Dr. Payne actually, is under contract with DOC to revalidate the pretrial risk assessment tool, and part of that revalidation analysis will include rates of rearrest. So that's forthcoming, but again, in the scheme of the criminal justice system and how quickly it operates, there just hasn't been enough time between the day these reforms went into effect and then the 6 months later when 312 went into effect for the system really to have stabilized enough and for us to get enough data to give the kind of date numbers and analysis that I think we would all wish that we had. But these are a start. And we bring them to you just because, you know, we're working on it and we hope that it can be at least some information for you to sort of keep in your mind as we move forward and hopefully get some more definitive answers for you going forward. So the next category is in the sentencing situation. So we started with the pretrial period. Now we're looking at people who've been convicted and sentenced. And moving on to slide 18, just reminding you that we had that principle to focus prison beds on serious and violent offenders. Why? Well, for one thing, it turns out that if you're a low-risk offender, time in prison can actually make you more likely to recidivate. So for some of those violent high-risk offenders, prison is the place they need to be. For some of those lower risk, let's just say property offenders, prison may not have the desired effect of reducing recidivism. In fact, it may have a little bit of the opposite effect. And so the thought was, can we be a little bit more targeted in how we use incarceration? Incarceration is a very expensive resource, and we want to use it the best way that we can to get the best results. And then that last point is just kind of a little rubric that I like to remind myself of. You know, prison should be used for who we're afraid of and maybe not so much for who we're mad at if we're trying to achieve recidivism reduction.
Ms. Pietro, we've got a question from Representative Carpenter.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bullet here on page 18 that says time in prison can make some low-risk offenders more likely to recidivate. Is that an opinion, or is that a fact-based, data-based observation?
That is a fact-based, data-based observation, and we actually have posted on our website our 2015 report that has footnotes showing all those studies that we're relying on to make that. And I should say that I would welcome anyone who has a different study. You know, all the time that the commission's been operating and talking about these studies, you know, I would just welcome people who would disagree with that, because it's the best research the highest quality, best research that we can find. And, you know, it does, you know, it's kind of a surprising finding.
Follow up?
Moving on. Yes, sorry?
Representative Carpenter?
I haven't seen the data, so I'm not going to follow up. Thank you.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I will, instead of just sending you to the website, I'll send you the specific info. Moving on to slide 19. So the question is, did the changes in the law cause us to focus our prison beds a little bit more on violent offenders? Here's a chart that suggests that we are slowly inching that way. And this is the kind of analysis this is a great example of the analysis that the commission is doing, you know, based on the statute. So, you know, one of the principles was, let's use the prison beds more for violent offenders, and then the question is, did we achieve that? Moving on to slide 20, I know there's been a lot of discussion about drug crimes.
I'm sorry, we've got a quick question from Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a reference made on the prior slide about defining low risk. A time in prison can make some low-risk offenders more likely How is low-risk offender maybe defined as property crime versus some other type of crime? Or what is the definition of a low-risk offender?
So through the chair, the studies that we were relying on is looking at some of those the risk assessments, such as the LSI, LSIR, that I think the Department of Corrections has talked to you all about in the past couple of weeks. I think a good shorthand way of thinking about it would be some of those misdemeanor property offenders, although some of those could be high risk too. Was that responsive?
Yes, I think. Yes. Yeah, thank you. We got a question
still
from.
Don't know what a low risk offender is. That's okay.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some may not know what the definition is between the violent versus nonviolent prisoners. Can you give us the list of how those are divided out, please? Ms. DiPietro?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard. Yeah, the commission uses the Department of Corrections definitions of violent versus nonviolent, the same list of statutes. I don't have it handy, but I certainly could provide it.
Well, can you give just a general overview? You don't have a list of that?
Okay, so through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, you know, just about any offense in 1141 would be a violent offense. Theft offenses normally, so 1146 offenses, generally, rule of thumb, would probably not be included as violent.
That's okay. We'll get a list. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative Josephson.
On that point, through the chair, Ms. DiPietro, my memory is that the 1161 offenses were not put in that violent category, and that was troublesome to me because this includes firing a firearm from an operating vehicle. I hope that the commission will consider that violent and treat it accordingly in the data.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't know specifically about that if that's your memory, that could be correct, but as I said, the commission does rely on the Department of Corrections sort of categories, so, and I just, off the top of my head, I can't remember where that falls.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Pietro, if you could please continue.
Let's see. So on slide 20, looking at the drug, these are admissions to prison for drug crimes. What this slide shows is that before reform, when possession of like heroin and opiates and methamphetamine was a possession of small amounts was a C felony, that there were a number of admissions in a fiscal year for that C felony. And after reform, when the crime of possession became a misdemeanor, that the number of felony admissions went down, but the number of misdemeanor offenses went up, although it's still not as large as the felony C offenses were originally. And I guess one thing that I find interesting about this slide is that the felony B offenses, which are the distribution offenses, they're not going down. So that's an encouraging part of this slide to me anyways, because the research shows that there's no great way obviously to deal with drug crimes. I don't think anyone's figured really this out or anything out, but the way most people who've thought about it and studied it think about it is that you try to arrest and prosecute vigorously the commercial distributors and the commercial level dealers. Get them out of the system. They will be replaced, but to try to disrupt that part of the supply chain, and then as in terms of the possessors or the people who are possessing small amounts or maybe just selling a little bit to a friend for their money, it's not necessarily helpful to convict them of a felony. And it is not necessarily helpful, although it could be if they get treatment, but it's not necessarily helpful to give them a significant amount of prison time. So that's the research base, and that underlied the changes. And then this slide, you know, gives you a little idea of, you know, sort of how things are working under the new scheme.
We've got a question from Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. DiPietro. The concern that I think some of us have is that in those white spaces, the white background above the 17 and 18 fiscal year bars, there's untold drug usage, because it's not plausible that there isn't, and that there's that sort of marked decline during an opiate epidemic, and that we're not treating those people in that void. Is the commission looking into that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you know, that's a really important point. Are possessors being arrested post-reform is one question. If they're not arrested, are they seeking treatment? That's a hard one to figure out. But I think, you know, that is a very, very good point, and it's important to look at that. And I think the commission is very concerned about, you know, how we, I mean, obviously, with the heroin epidemic, and not just heroin, but, you know, other drugs, meth also is a big problem. So, yeah, that is a concern.
Representative.
And it's something to look at. It's not necessarily that the law didn't change an officer's ability to arrest a person for drug possession, but there may be unintended consequences, you know, with the number of those arrests going down, potentially. I don't have that data right now, but that's something we need to look into.
And are you?
No, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the statutory goals of what our mission was here, what our objectives were, what does this slide depict success of?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, to the extent that the goal was designed to decrease the amount of incarceration, we're using, well, I guess two ways to think about it. That the part of the goal was for simple possessors to not be convicted of a felony, which impedes their ability to get a job, get housing, and sort of rehabilitate themselves. So to the extent that was the goal, I think this chart shows that fewer people who are possessing small amounts are being convicted of C felonies. But I think it also shows that the total number of admissions for drug crimes has gone down. And as Representative Josephson pointed out, that's something that needs to be looked into.
I would just make an argument that maybe we don't need, maybe the employment wasn't necessary, considering the next slide is a rather disturbing increase in theft crimes. I would say that we've reduced the numbers of low-level drug users in jail only to increase the amount of thefts going on, and I would say that doesn't pass the common sense test. I don't really care that less people are in prison if we have more thefts going on, unless I'm specifically looking at this solely from a financial point of view. I guess that was more a statement than a question, sorry.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, if we move on to 21, these are actually admissions to prison for theft crimes, although later on I do have some slides on larceny theft. So, and this just shows that, you know, that people are still being arrested and admitted to prison for misdemeanor and felony theft crimes. So one of the things that we would want to look at is, since we've lessened some of the penalties for some of those smaller thefts, would we then see that same situation where, there's sort of, a huge decrease in the number of people coming in. And so we don't see that here. I guess that's the limited purpose of this slide right here, slide 21.
We've got a question, Representative Carpenter.
So I haven't had enough time here to look to see what the math is, but we have a decrease in admissions for drug crimes, looks like low-level drug crimes, and then we have an increase in admissions for theft crimes. So where's the net overall?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I guess I'm sorry, I'm not under. Can you restate the question? The net change in admissions, or?
Yes, and so maybe we've got another slide that's going to show it here in just a minute.
Yeah, okay, so 22 might help a little bit.
Violent, nonviolent.
With that question, this might be a little bit too broad to really
Neither
answer
of these
it.
Are violent or-
So again, looking, these are admissions, prison admissions. So this is the number of people coming in. And, again, we're looking at, all right, what's increasing, what's not increasing, how's the system responding to not just the changes in the law, but just to everything. And so this slide shows that since 54 was passed, there has been a little bit of an uptick in admissions for the nonviolent crimes, which includes more than theft. So this isn't exactly the answer to your question. But then earlier there was a question or a discussion about the prison population, and the prison population has gone down since reform, and this chart shows it. And I should say, showing you a chart of prison population is difficult because the prison population fluctuates quite a bit. Those prior slides were admissions. Those were sort of counting people coming in on certain charges. This one attempts to show you on a snapshot day how many people were sitting in beds in the Department of Corrections. So a little bit it depends on which day you choose. I just want to be really clear about sort of how we're counting things. What you can be sure of is that we've chosen the same day each year to sort of count. So we're trying to make it consistent year to year so that we can look and see, what the trends are.
I've got another two questions, Representative Carpenter and then Johnston. Representative Carpenter.
Yeah, so just a real quick math, and you can check me on this. We've seen admissions for drug crimes from fiscal year 15 to 18, generally, because the numbers might be a little off here, somewhere around 1,200 total admissions in fiscal year 15 to somewhere around 700 in 18. So you're looking at a difference of 500, a decline of 500. And then you're looking at well over 800 increase over the same period for theft crimes. I'm not sure what we succeeded at. It looks like we added people to the prison population.
So through the chair, one of the it's hard to give a big picture without you want to show things in a variety of different ways. So those prior slides, as I was mentioning, are admissions. So for example, a person who is counted in slide 21 for an admission for theft may have come in, served his or her sentence, and gone out and not been counted on the day that we took the prison population snapshot in 23. And the reason we look at both admissions and sort of a static population snapshot are we want to, try to measure the churn. So we might see that admissions are up. In other words, people sort of cycling in and then leaving. But the prison population itself, sort of on average over time is maybe not increasing as fast or not increasing at all even. And so that's why we want to show both, because it would be misleading to just show admissions or to just show the prison population, number of people in a prison bed on a given day in 2017 or 2018. So it's you can't add the numbers in 2021 and 22 to get to 23. I'm sorry about that, but.
Follow up. I was not suggesting that we were adding those numbers to get to the slides. All I'm pointing out, I mean, they're your slides. I'm just pointing out that there's a decline in prison population, quote, success for drug crimes, and then an increase in population for thefts on slide 21. And so I'm not sure what the policy, the effect we were trying to get with the policies we put in. We've actually incarcerated more people. Anyway.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I can offer one thought on that, and that it would be speculation. And, you know, like Dr. Payne, we try not to, you know, speculate, but the question is always why, like what does it mean? So one of the things that we're hearing is, I mean, there can be people who are using or possessing substances who are not committing crimes. And what we're hearing is, like, those people may not be being arrested, but the ones who are using and possessing and committing crimes, now they're going to be arrested. That would be a higher priority to arrest them and get them into the system. So between 20 and 21, I personally don't see a contradiction, but that's just sort of a theory, and I take your point. I'm not trying to argue. I mean, I definitely understand where you're coming from.
And we have Representative Johnston and then Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Chair. We're getting close to our time limit as far as when this is supposed to be over, so I'm going to ask you a global question, and maybe you can either answer it today or get back to me. One is, on your data, is that ACOM that you're getting most of the data from as far as Department of Corrections, those snapshots?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
The next question I have, because we're policymakers down here, and when I look at the members of the Criminal Justice Commission, I think, wow, this is great. You're getting all the right people at the table and the right people to be looking at the data and the right people to be querying the data and asking for more data. My question to you is, when was the last time you've met, and how often do you meet, and do you meet more than statutorily required, and have all of these folks met since January?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the statute requires four times a year. The commission usually meets every other month, and it has work groups that typically meet in the off months, and that's been true pretty much since the inception. In terms of since the new gubernatorial administration has come in, the commission has had at least one meeting down in Juneau and has another meeting scheduled this month. And the new commissioners, at the time they were the commissioner designees, came themselves or sent representatives. But bottom line is, you know, the commission hasn't really stabilized around the new members yet. And then, of course, the public defender, that's up in the air now, too. So that's another membership that's, you know, not quite stabilized.
Thank you.
And
so on the supervision,
Ms. DiPietro?
I always leave supervision for last because
we bumped up to our 3:30 deadline for the end of this meeting.
And thank you, Ms. Representative Johnson. We'll give one more question, Representative LeBon, and then we'll go ahead and adjourn out for the day. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is real quick and easy. Slide number 23 shows a period from 2010 through 2000 or into 2018, but slides number 21 and 22 go back to 2015. Would it help us understand trends if we were looking at that same eight-year period on slides 21, 22, and 23?
Through the chair, it certainly could, and I can certainly push it back, push the number 23 back a little bit earlier. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. DiPietro. Representative Wilson is presenting one of her bills in another committee right now, so she had to step out. I believe the intent was for members to go ahead and read through the presentation, the rest of it, on their own. But if there was a desire to have Ms. DiPietro back, certainly folks could maybe let Representative Wilson know, and that could be scheduled if necessary. And so is there anything else to come for the committee? I don't see anything. Are there any final closing comments you'd like to make, Ms. DiPietro, before we adjourn?
My only closing comment is to really thank you so much for your time and attention. And just to remind you, we're happy to do any analysis that you would find useful. And just to direct your attention to slide 28, which I think has some great feedback on how the Department of Corrections is working on its probation and parole discharges. Thank you.
Great, and thank you for the work you're doing over there. And so with that, we will be adjourned to tomorrow, Saturday, April 27th at 10 a.m., and we will continue our discussion on HB 20, which is the sexual assault examination kits. And with that, we will be adjourned at 3:36 p.m. Thank you.